Hello, it's Monday the 19th of July. I'm Richard Spur, in for Andrew Pearce, coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Still to come today, you'll get the reaction of the nightclub sector to Freedom Day. Also, the worries of spyware targeting thousands of people through their phones. As the so-called lobster bill gets closer to being passed through Parliament, you'll be hearing from the Countryside Alliance. And as plays in the West End and TV programmes in the UK are cancelled due to COVID, we'll hear from Emma Powell, our showbiz correspondent. Almost all coronavirus restrictions in England have been axed today. Legal requirements to wear masks and social distance have been dropped, and nightclubs have been allowed to open for the first time in 16 months. So what will Freedom Day mean for the battered nightclub sector? I'm joined by Sasha Lord, nighttime economy advisor for Greater Manchester and co-founder of Parklife Festival. Sasha, let me just begin by asking you what this means to you today.
Well, I stayed up last night, Richard, and saw the queues and people dancing on the dance floors at 1 minute past 12. And it brought a smile to my face. You know, in Greater Manchester, we've been in tougher restrictions than I think the rest of the UK, bar possibly Leicester. So, yeah, for many, it's a great relief. But I have an issue with this, the branding, if I'm being honest, this terminology, Freedom Day. I think it's created so much divided anger. For me, today is more of a personal choice day. You know, if you want to wear a mask, carry on doing that. If you want to social distance, carry on doing that. If you want table service, set the table, do that. If you want to go to the bar, do it. And people are being actually quite aggressive with each other. So I would just say to everybody listening to this, please just respect each other now.
Do you think people are going to still be a little bit wary about going into clubs where it's very difficult to control social distancing? And you know, you could, in effect, be creating a bit of a microcosm of the Delta variant.
I think so. I think, and let's not, you know, put the spotlight just on nightclubs. It's theatres, it's live music venues, grassroots venues. You know, they're all opening as well. I think certainly, you know, the younger audience, from what I'm seeing, the 18 to 23 year olds, they're out and about. We saw that, didn't we, on social media last night. I think for people that fall more in my category, you know, it's getting on to 50, I will still remain with social distance in place. There will be certain circumstances where I'll wear a mask, whether it's on public transport or to the supermarket, and not necessarily just to protect myself, but to respect other people as well.
Presumably, there are going to be a number, sadly, of late night venues across the UK which simply haven't been able to survive the lack of being able to open over the pandemic.
It's been a disaster. I don't need to spell this out. I think everybody knows, you know, how tough it's been for hospitality. I suspect the only silver lining is going into this, hospitality was always sort of put at the back of the queue. I think the public now have seen how badly hospitality has been treated, and people will start to respect the industry a lot more. And let's not forget, it's the fifth biggest industry in the whole of the UK. But yes, you're quite right. There are many, many venues that just simply haven't made it. They've handed the keys back. And sadly, with that comes huge redundancies as well.
How are you going to reassure people that if they do go along to some of the venues that we've been talking about, they can do so safely?
I think it's down to people's personal choice, if I'm being honest. There are some venues that I'm seeing some great ideas, actually, in Greater Manchester, where some pubs especially are offering a hybrid opportunity. So if you want to walk in there wearing your mask and have table service, you can do. If you want to go and order your pints at the bar, you can do. So I kind of like that approach. I think today, you know, it should be a cautious approach moving forward on this.
And just finally, historically, although less so now because so many people date and meet up online, nightclubs have been the place where you go to find a partner, maybe for the evening, maybe for longer, depending on just what sort of a market you're in. Are you going to be dissuading people from getting, shall we say, intimate?
Well, do you know something? That is the first time in 60 months I've actually been asked that question. But, you know, I'd say if you're on a dance floor shoulder to shoulder, then it's not far away from a kiss, is it? So a curveball question at the end. I enjoyed that one. I don't know what the right answer is, but it's certainly put a smile on my face.
I'm sure people will find a way around it. Sasha, many thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Richard.
That was Sasha Lord, nighttime economy advisor for Greater Manchester and co-founder of Parklife Festival. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Journalists, human rights activists and lawyers have been among those targeted with a phone virus which allowed governments to snoop on victims unnoticed. A list of 50,000 phone numbers of people who've been targeted by the Israeli surveillance firm includes the wife of Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered and dismembered by a Saudi death squad. I'm joined by Tom Davison, International Technical Director at Lookout. Tom, I'm going to begin, if I may, by asking you, for the uninitiated really, what is spyware?
Yeah, sure. So, well, principally, spyware is something that will aim to get on your computer or your mobile phone with a view of finding out information about you without you knowing, essentially. So it's not dissimilar to anything that someone might use to survey an individual. Of course, with a mobile device, which is what we've been talking about recently, is the fact that you have so much information on there now, so many sensors, so many bits of personal and work data, which become interesting. So this is what we're seeing now.
How dangerous and intricate can these pieces of software be? Because we're hearing here in this case about cases of military-grade spyware.
Yes, and I think what's interesting, and perhaps people are unaware of, is that this is an industry now. So much the same way that you have people making, you know, physical weapons, physical initiatives, you have the same in cyber. So you have people that are commercial organizations that are well-resourced, well-funded, hundreds of employees that are focused on building these tools, which they can legally sell, which they're doing. So that's perhaps what people are unaware of, that it's not just the criminal underworld, it's actually a public industry that's going on here.
What is the legal use of spyware, for example?
Well, the way tools like this would be sold would be under a license agreement between the manufacturer, the vendor, and the person that would be buying, or normally the organization, government, that would be buying it. And it would be intended for use as lawful intercept against criminals and terrorists and so on. Mm. So that's how it would be marketed and sold.
Just talk a little bit about who these NSO Group people are.
Yeah, so NSO Group is it's a private company. They've been around since 2011, I believe. They were held private. They actually were bought out, and then there was a management takeover back again in 2019, which valued the company at about $1 billion at the time. I think in 2017 they had about 500 employees, so they're not an insignificant organization.
What here are the implications for these 50,000 people who are believed to have been affected?
Well, what we're seeing here is a leak of a file containing names and phone numbers of people that are allegedly potentially, you know, being targeted by this surveillance, where there's no hard information to suggest that's the case. And of course, NSO Group are denying that that's been the case. But I think the key point here is that these tools exist. They are traded, they're sold legally. And then their usage is really down to, or the way they're used is down to the people that are operating them, that have control over them. And in this case, NSO don't operate the tool on behalf of their customers. They sell it on under license, and then it's used in whichever way the customer sees fit, which of course should be bound by the license agreement. What's more challenging for the rest of the people out there is to understand if that's really the case, and that's why this has been in the media this week and has been of such interest.
What sort of people are the ones who've been affected?
Well, as I say, allegedly, that there's a list of names which are supposedly going to be released as the week goes on. At a high level, they've talked about potentially targeting rights activists, journalists, lawyers, and so on. So, you know, this is what's been alleged.
Do we know where the leak came from?
No, I don't personally.
And do we know if any of these people have actually been hacked?
I'm not in a position to to say yes or no. I can only go on what's been reported. I think at this stage, what's been reported is that there's a large list of names, and the supposition is that these are potential targets. Whether they've actually been hacked or not is not possible to say. There has been a paper released by Amnesty, which has talked about some of the forensic work that they've done to identify devices that they believe have been hacked, and they've shared a lot of information about that on their website.
And just a quick broader question, what can any member of the public do if they suspect that their phone may have been infected with spyware?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think a key point here is that even if you may not feel that you'd be directly targeted by this piece of spyware, what we see is lots of techniques that become commoditized, that find their way into some of the more amateur pieces of spyware and malware out there. So, you know, key things are fairly straightforward. It's about not clicking on links that you don't recognize. It's about only installing mobile applications from public app stores such as Google Play and the Apple App Store. And just keep an eye on your phone. If you start to see strange behavior like excessive battery usage or high data usage, that could be an indicator, or you know, things crashing unexpectedly. And finally, you know, you can download software. There are tools out there, just like on a desktop computer, that will aim to protect your device and monitor its usage and check things are behaving as they should be.
Brilliant. That was Tom Davison, International Technical Director at Lookout. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all of our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus. The new Animal Welfare Sentience Bill is being pushed through Parliament, and some fear it could pander to eco-zealots and have an impact not only on farming and fishing, but on hunting, angling and horse racing. The Countryside Alliance and other groups have said the bill is in danger of becoming a Trojan horse for an extreme agenda that the government never intended and will come to regret. Well, I'm joined now by Tim Bonner, Chief Exec of the Countryside Alliance. Can I begin by asking you why the Countryside Alliance opposes the bill?
Well, we don't oppose all of the bill. We have no issue at all with the concept that that certain animals are sentient. It's a fact. It's not a principle or anything else. And Parliament has been legislating on animal welfare issues for nearly 200 years now, and that is on the basis that animals are sentient. If they're not sentient, if they don't feel things, then you can't compromise their welfare. So there would be no point having animal welfare legislation. So our concern isn't that. Our concern really is that within this bill, there is a proposal to set up a committee which would essentially rule on every decision that every minister made to decide whether or not they had given all due consideration to the welfare of sentient animals, the welfare of animals which have already been decided as sentient. And that, we think, could have an extraordinary impact across government, a chilling effect on ministerial decisions. And it contrasts really quite significantly with the way that the law treats rural people and other groups of people who don't have a statutory committee to look after their interests. So there's a fundamental concern about animals being treated in some ways in a higher manner than some groups of people.
I can understand how this is going to affect very directly fishermen, for example, perhaps the lack of ability in the future to transport live crabs and lobsters and langoustines. I don't see quite so much how it affects the countryside context.
Well, this isn't just the countryside. I mean, this potentially affects everything. So a minister making a decision, an example that the animal rights, the animal welfare groups themselves have used, so the minister making a decision to build a power station, will be answerable to this committee as to whether he or she has considered the impact of that decision on the welfare of the sentient animals that might be displaced or have to be culled as a result of that.
So do you not think that's a good thing, though?
Well, if it is taken in context, yes, because there has to be balance. We all know that everything we do has an impact on wild animals and in some places on domestic animals. You know, if we decide to eat a burger, then you're driving a demand for cattle and cattle farming. If you eat a farm produce, even if you're a vegetarian, that produce is being grown on land which would otherwise be available for wild animals. So everything we do has an impact, and it's all about balance. And we're concerned that there is a huge potential, frankly, for this to become a significant critic of government, and therefore something that government ministers will be constantly looking over their shoulders with very serious concerns about the fact that they're going to be held up as not having upheld the welfare of animals, when in fact what they're trying to do is the best for people.
It seems that Boris Johnson's public opinion when it comes to animal welfare and to the conservation of the environment has evolved rather dramatically since he first took office. Are you worried that maybe people behind the Prime Minister, let's say his wife, who's been cited as a big supporter of this, are actually driving this change in style and this change in the law when it comes to sentient animals?
I think there's plenty of there's a raft of government legislation on animal welfare at the moment. I mean, this is just one of half a dozen bills that is being proposed or has been passed recently, and most of those would have our full support. For instance, the government's just pushed through a bill on sentencing, which means people who are committing the worst acts of cruelty to animals can now be in prison for 5 years rather than 6 months. Now, you'd find no disagreement, myself, my members, or the countryside, for legislation like that. But I think what there is the potential for some of this legislation to be waylaid, and for the current government to consider that it's perfectly reasonable for them to set up a committee with independent people to give this sort of thing consideration, not thinking through the full consequences of how this might happen when there are future governments further down the road. So we are concerned that some of this could simply get out of hand, and we think that the basic principle behind this bill could be implemented without the dangers that could come with a powerful statutory committee wandering around government criticising ministers' decisions.
So without the committee and their autonomy, you would support the bill?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. We have absolutely no concerns. In fact, we fully support ensuring that consideration of the welfare of animals, of sentient animals, is part of the parliamentary process. It's how you do that, which is the question, and how you balance that against the needs and requirements of people. And that forever has been a really challenging decision-making process for ministers, for government as a whole. And we are worried that it would become destabilised by having a committee which is just considering the welfare of animals, and which isn't in the same way considering the welfare of people.
Brilliant. That was Tim Bonner, Chief Exec of the Countryside Alliance. Cinderella, Andrew Lloyd Webber's new musical, is under threat after Webber was forced to suspend weekend matinee and evening performances due to COVID-related precautionary measures. The beleaguered West End has also seen productions of Hairspray starring Michael Ball and the Browning version with Kenneth Branagh postponed or shelved entirely. Well, I'm joined now by Emma Powell, the Daily Mail's show business correspondent. Tell me then, to start with, how many plays have been paused or closed because of COVID?
Well, I mean, we're sort of getting into double figures now. It just seems to be happening constantly. As fast as one play seems to open, they close again. I mean, some of them already. Kenneth Branagh's production of the Browning version has been cancelled. At the weekend, the Globe had to cancel a matinee performance of The Tempest. Cinderella cancelled both performances on Saturday. Very short notice, but obviously it can't be helped. You know, if you get pinged, and they don't really have any sort of control over when that might happen and how long it might be that they're out. I mean, if you look at The Prince of Egypt, they were looking forward to reverting to full capacity today, but got a ping last week after a member of the production tested positive, and they're now out until July 21st. It just feels never ending right now.
Today, nightclub owners and those that like to go to nightclubs are reveling and celebrating that they've got back to normal. It really has been appalling for the performing arts, hasn't it, this pandemic and these lockdowns. What hope now is there, though, to cling on to, that the path of live performance, as Lord Lloyd Webber, amongst others, has been championing, will sometime get back to normal?
I mean, the live entertainment industry has been completely crippled by the pandemic and now this pingdemic, because, you know, as fast as they're excited to get back on their feet, it's the curtain sort of coming down on the West End and the whole industry again. I think The way out of this, the way it seems to be, is similar to what happened the other week with Bridgerton. Somebody tested positive as part of the crew. They isolated. They did a load of tests. That person was isolated. And they were able to get filming again with only one day out because of the testing. So if we can implement that in theatre, then hopefully we can actually carry on performances without having to have 10 days of isolation, no performances, and then back on again, and then sort of up in the air as to whether they might have 1, 2 days, 2 weeks before they get another ping. It's going to come down to the testing. That is the only way that they can keep open. Otherwise, it's just this unpredictable sort of age that we're in, where no one knows whether they're coming or going.
Do you think that the performing arts in this country will ever get back to health?
I think you've got to hope that they will. I mean, we are, like I said with the Bridgerton example, if we can do that, and, you know, okay, they may have to miss a matinee if someone gets pinged quite close to the start, but if it means they can then restart again for the evening performance or the following day, then hopefully we can see a way out of this. It doesn't mean that they're being crippled for weeks at a time when, you know, they've been 18 months with sort of not much support and not being able to open.
And it's not just the theatre, is it? As we've already referenced, to TV productions and film. How do you think this is going to affect our range of viewing entertainment options in the future?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we went into lockdown last year, I think we all panicked, didn't we? Thinking, what on earth are we going to watch in sort of a year, 2 years' time? Because everything's been stopped. It's come to a standstill. And yes, lots of productions have been halted. Mission Impossible 7 was halted for 2 weeks in June because of positive COVID tests. Last week, obviously, there was the Bridgerton debacle where they had to have a day off. Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg's new show, Masters of the Air, has been halted, reportedly due to several cases within the cast and crew. Again, you know, if they can get this testing under control, where you can have a rapid test and you can ensure that the case was isolated, but it doesn't mean every single person working on that production has to be in isolation for 10 days up, then, you know, we can sort of expect to keep this industry going. And yes, we will have new TV shows and films to watch in the coming months and years, but it's just a matter of being able to do this and finding some way around this pandemic that is just completely crippling art, film, TV and theatre.
And you know, what's the situation for the likes of Michael Ball or Kenneth Branagh? If a musician or an actor has a show shut down, do they still get paid?
That's the thing. What do you do at the moment? And yes, people are still getting paid, but obviously the theatres are just going to be losing money. I mean, as Andrew Lloyd Webber said a few months ago, he's lost an extortionate amount of money. He's lost more than $1 million a month while the theatres were closed and had to remortgage a home to sort of help cover the cost. So yes, these people will still get paid, but, you know, the money's not coming in. The theatres are putting themselves.
I suspect Lord Lloyd Webber won't have to survive on tins of corned beef. I think he's got a little bit put aside. But it's the young actors, not necessarily young actors, who are still at the start of their career or maybe haven't worked for some time, who I feel sorry for, because, you know, they really wouldn't have any source of income because they're not contracted, so they don't get furloughed. They're falling in between the slats, aren't they, here?
They are. And the sad thing as well is you like to hope that this isn't actually going to put people off of going into sort of stage, music, live events, because this has been a catastrophic year for anybody in the arts, theatre, even film and TV at the beginning of this lockdown. And, you know, lots of people we've seen already have made career changes because they just couldn't cope. They may have made temporary career changes, but now decided, actually, I'm going to carry on down this route and I'm going to turn my back on acting and performing. You've just got to hope that this does sort of get back on its feet. We get away around this sort of having to isolate for 10 days at a time when somebody, part of a production, gets pinged, and that actually people will continue to stay in this industry and get it back up and running, and that youngsters will keep coming through and they won't be put off by how catastrophic it's been in the last year.
That was Emma Powell, the Daily Mail's show business correspondent. That's all we have time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Richard Spur for Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have a great evening. Good night.